Welcome, everybody. The tradition here is that, Mike, and I hope with your permission, people can get up and get second helping.
So of course, like, you know, so totally.
Some of these are hungry undergraduates. they're between rigorous classes.
Absolutely.
Mike, it's a real pleasure for us at Boise Center to welcome you. Mike is, as some of you know already, Associate Professor in the Communications Department here at DC. Before he put on his professor's hat, he was actually a journalist for the Houston Press, and he's written popular essays in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and other places. His teaching and research here at BC focuses on media production, advertising, popular culture, and political communication. And hopefully, thank you for providing us with your little thing. His most recent book from NYU Press is called The Power of Sports, Media and Spectacle in American Culture, which presents a behind-the-scenes investigation of leaders and professionals in the media business. The book analyzes how sports culture explains and reflects contemporary American life. So please join me in welcome Mike as our speaker today.
Thank you so much. I just want to start off by just saying thank you so much for coming out. This is really, really nice of you, especially what's a very busy time of year and everybody's sick right now. So I'm really super grateful. Thank you so
much.
No one's going to get sick from here. Thank you so much to Father Mark and the Boise Center. Thank you to Susan and Zach for their help in arranging this. It means a lot to be able to share some work with you. This was a project that was about 4 years in the making. I figured I'd speak for about 25 minutes or so. I find that if I usually go longer than that, people start to nod off. So I'm going to actually set my timer right here, so I'm reminding myself. And then we can spend the second half just, you know, opening it up for discussion and sort of feedback and stuff. So let me begin, as many fans do each morning, with the box score. Because of the last half century, sports has ballooned in slow motion before our eyes. Ours is an age of sporting excess, right down to the infinitude of statistics that crawl across the ticker during games. Globally, the industry is worth somewhere between $200 and $700 billion. That's tickets, broadcast rights, sponsorship, apparel, and facilities. Last year, sports made up 89 of the top 100 most watched TV programs. Sports is the biggest reason that your cable bills have exploded. And not only has there never been a crash in the market, but even in the middle of the Great Recession, the growth rate of sports still exceeded that of almost every nation's GDP. Indeed, sports make us act economically irrationally. They disfigure collective priorities when hundreds of D1 athletics departments bleed out in the red, antitrust-exempt professional leagues extort billions of dollars in taxpayer money for new stadia, and citizens buy into the fuzzy math that hosting an Olympics or World Cup is somehow economically beneficial. Heck, if you've ever bought a pair of branded sneakers, you've acted illogically. The power and allure of those Air Jordans is entirely imaginary and symbolic, not material and functional. We think neither of the exploited garment workers who made them, nor can we actually consciously believe that we too might fly like Mike, even as this is precisely the con job that all branding is predicated upon. Nike doesn't make shoes. It makes meaning. But why do we worship at this altar of sports myth when it costs us so much? The answer and the esoteric essence of fandom might be found at an altar of a very different sort. Emile Durkheim has some answers. The pioneering sociologist wrote in the wake of the Industrial Revolution, an age that tore apart traditional communities and freighted individuals with social ennui, that feeling of disorder and alienation that plagues our modern world. Yet to understand how people could ideally be stitched together by collective conscience, he had to go back to religion in its simplest form, where he excavated a profound, efficient conclusion. Whenever a group or society worships a divine form, it is also, in fact, simultaneously worshiping itself. Religion is not then about cosmic order, it's about social order. Religious totems, while officially symbolizing deities, implicitly offer vessels for fellowship, licenses to congregate together. There's something universal and enduring in that tribal yearning. We need it still today desperately. Yet much of the Western world has profoundly secularized over the centuries. Nearly 60 million Americans now are religiously unaffiliated, and formal faith no longer defines reality and forms the basis of identity and community as it once did. Sports culture, I argue in this book, helps fill that vacuum. It articulates the language of belief, furnishes homilies of moral judgment, structures systems of meaning-making, and paves pathways to transcendence. it simulates the human experience long derived from faith when many are formally divorced from it. Through sports, we think, feel, and act spiritually. That's more essential than ever in an era of deep cultural fragmentation and communal breakdown, when we've lost faith in all manner of public institutions. Information cocoons filter out contrary representations of ideological reality. Political polarization charts new depths of hatred and disgust. Yet we also have entertainment cocoons that define our time, smartphone distractions that seclude us alone together in social settings. The algorithmic targeting of pop content splintered taste beyond blockbusters that were once broadly cast to mass audiences, and the bewildering complexity of today's best TV content repels casual consumption and therefore common conversation. You can't simply drop in on the Game of Thrones season finale without massive time investment beforehand, and in my case, Wikipedia and a notepad. Game 7 of the NBA Finals is considerably less befuddling, even if you didn't catch the previous six. In short, peak TV is great for art, less so for widespread social communion. Sports, on the other hand, still offers the glue of collective consciousness that the acid of modern life has otherwise dissolved. In large part, this is because sports tells us what time it is. They anchor players and fans in the present moment, concentrate a vast shared psychic energy on events that are unfolding before us right now. They orient observers, synchronize schedules, coordinate collectivity. Being in the moment is incredibly lucrative for advertisers in a time-shifted age of DVR and streaming. But it's also existentially critical for us living through asynchronous postmodernity, when people seek mindfulness individually and co-presence socially against the onslaught of distraction and multitasking. Unlike most all pop culture, sports resists being on demand. It instead demands of you co-presence with others at specifically scheduled intersections. Now, I think there's something sacred in that communal immediacy, that ephemeral ecstasy of everyone seeming to be on the same page as the scroll of history unfolds. As David Stern told me, as life gets more impersonal, the last places that people are likely to gather are going to be houses of worship and houses of sports worship. I agree. The book tries to understand how this spectacle is staged. It studies the production of mediated sports and analyzes their cultural and political implications. What makes sports most compelling is what it can tell us about non-sports issues and contexts in America today. I draw upon 42 hours of interviews with 57 professionals, talking with writers and editors, anchors and producers, marketers and clients, and teams and agents. And the book and this talk is divided into four parts: journalism, commercialism, gender, and politics. First off, sports journalism has always been defined by complicated allegiances. It helps manufacture the illusion that the outcome actually matters. It helps make fans, and it makes those who sell to them fabulously wealthy, doling out free publicity that would be the envy of every other business in America. Quid pro quo, one columnist told me, if a team advertises big in our paper, we'll cover them more. It's a hand-feeding-my-hand kind of thing. Front and center here is ESPN, which has to cover the same content that it shells out billions of dollars to broadcast. Famously, it withdrew from the League of Denial concussion investigation, but less obviously, it's incentivized to ignore non-rights partners like the NHL. That's NBC, and it's their product. So ESPN, they say to themselves, well, why should we push this product for audiences to go watch NBC? Why should we tell these stories? Sports reporters tend to perform stenography at post-game news conferences, tossing up softball cliches like talk about X or how big was Y. The revolving door of former athletes turned media members disables any distance or detachment that journalism might otherwise require. They're never going to point at any kind of systemic abuse. They're part of the industry. What you tended to see was the intimidating factor of these big, handsome jocks looking at the real sportscasters, the professional sportscaster, and telling them off-air, hey, what the fuck do you know? You never played the game. Such default hagiography has given us LeBron's The Decision infomercial and NBC's Olympics Week tearjerker puffery. Direct access to players has gotten so much harder, even as they're far more accessible to the public through social and owned media channels. They can launder a monologue through the Players Tribune or through team websites. That's something you need to internalize, that we are our own media company. When someone goes to find out something about me or the team or a player and they go to Google and they type that in, I don't want the Washington Post to get the most clicks. I want the most clicks. Every media outlet is basically competing with the teams they cover nowadays. And reporters' fear of being ostracized divides insiders from outsiders. It was TMZ that exposed domestic abuser Ray Rice, serial philanderer Tiger Woods, and unreconstructed racist Donald Sterling, maybe because TMZ's parent company doesn't have the rights entanglements with all those leagues. These outsider digerati, from Deadspin to Bill Simmons to Barstool, inspire a more irreverent, more partisan way of talking sports. And they forge a new basis for journalistic authority. You can trust Simmons because he's loved the Sox his whole life, not because he's been trained to cover them objectively or even had the means to do so. Meanwhile, what had been a broadcast environment of information scarcity has given way to a digital landscape of endless plenitude, a cyclically exhausting escalation of input and output on camera phones, Twitter, talk radio, SportsCenter. More space demands more content, which demands cheaper labor. One aspiring blogger for Bleacher Report earned $200 for 500 articles that got 3 million views. Unlike the morning newspaper or nightly highlights, online content has no restrictions on time or space. It's boundless, unshackled from former parameters like column inches or segment length. Journalists feel pressure to constantly churn out new installments, clickbaiting eyeballs with unsubstantiated sensationalism. Networks feel pressure to solicit and integrate fan feedback through polls, tweets, comments, and the like, whether that give and take is even interesting to us. And leagues feel pressure to try to lure Google and Facebook for rights bids someday, now that one-third of 20-somethings have cut the cable cord. In today's media boiler room, there is no off switch. I call this news cyclone the hot take industrial complex. It's media output that confuses trolling for journalism. I don't think our audience really wants facts. They want their opinions validated. As a journalist, there's part of me that grits my teeth a little bit because it's so different than how I was trained to be, Janelle Hill told me. Another ESPN producer bemoaned, it's very difficult for our radio hosts because we're always asking them to have strong opinions. And what if they don't have one? It's almost like you have to force one. That's the only way that you can stand out. That's the only way that you can keep people listening to you, to have crazier opinions. Everything's getting pushed to the extremes. Part of this is due to scores being available everywhere instantaneously on our smartphones, which incentivizes interpretation, emboldens the outrageous. Yay says the Stephen A's. From a supply side, talk is cheap. You don't have to go out and have reporters gathering information. You don't have to have bureaus. It's an easy way to fill the time. Hot takes dictate more Deflategate. They trigger more TiVo. The hot take industrial complex also emerges alongside an overwhelming commercialization of our media content, for advertising is geographically imperialistic, looking for new territories it has not yet conquered. It's almost impossible to watch sports nowadays without a brand aggressively, annoyingly poking in the way. When Daily Fantasy flooded network coffers with $200 million in revenue, their native ad messages began popping up as in-show lineup recommendations. For $500,000 a pop, Fox will sell you six-second split-screen unskippable commercials during pitching mound visits and offensive huddles. And Peyton Manning issued the bizarre and untenable post-Super Bowl claim that he couldn't wait to get a Bud Light in his mouth, giving Anheuser-Busch $14 million in free media exposure. Wayne's World could scarcely have been more ham-handed in accommodating this product placement. Because everybody has a remote control and because more people DVR TV programs, advertisers have figured out that perhaps the best way to get their product noticed is to have it attached to the action itself, not a break between the action, Bob Costas explained to me. Another editor added, every single sales meeting I've been to used to be, we just wanted to let you know that we sold Town Fair Tire and there's going to be a billboard coming into your second segment. Now the meetings are, we want to sell the Town Fair Tire. How can we build a segment around that? That never used to happen. That is everywhere now. It's suffocating, truthfully. Teams and leagues are eager to affix a partner logo to every opportunity, right down to the official waste management company that disposes of effluvia at events. And sponsors want to cozy up as close to the action as possible, stationing Microsoft tablets, Apple iPads, and Bose headsets on the sidelines and in dugouts, assuring that Gatorade will be the conspicuous celebratory bath of choice, Werner, the latter used to trim down Final Four nets. Ford can't pay to have a base runner steal second in one of its Mustangs, but the NBA got Blake Griffin to jump over a Kia at its dunk contest. It was also the first major U.S. league to start slapping ads on jerseys. I asked David Stern if there was any line he could envision that would be off-limits to a commercial patron. It took him a few seconds to respond, like I'd asked him if he wanted to leave his wallet in the middle of Central Park. I guess we could say sponsor tattoos. I think we've drawn the limit at putting ads on the body of our athletes. He was joking. Yes. For teams, stars serve the same economic insurance policy that Tom Cruise furnishes his own film franchises, bankable attraction. For media, stars remain the choicest clickbait for headline schemes. Obviously, if you write Curry, if you write LeBron, if you write Kobe, you're going to get hits. It doesn't hurt to write about them as much as possible. And increasingly, sports celebrity capital is leveraged more off the court than on. Russell Westbrook declared, I don't want to be seen as just a basketball guy. I think of basketball as a great platform to jump off into different things. Things like cologne, jewelry, eyeglass frames, croco print luggage, and snakeskin slippers. He's part of a generation of player dandies who have turned the arena arrival tunnel walk into red carpet events. Queer eye for the point guard. Our association with Russell is not about what's on the court. It's all about celebrating the lifestyle of basketball, which exists so much off the court. What are these players doing outside of the court? What are they wearing? If all of this seems like a new ideal for manhood, you are not mistaken. Gender politics have never been all that subtle in sports. For millennia, really, they both defined and validated male identity for status, socialization, and supremacy. And to play like a big baller is to strut like a big baller. That deeply unsubtle conflation of game-time prowess and well-endowed virility. By contrast, the University of Iowa, for example, painted their visiting football locker rooms pink, apparently hoping to emasculate opponents through interior decor. In football, one of the more cliched rituals is that of the no-nonsense head coach who takes over as the new sheriff in town, ready to whip the troops into shape. Sports remains the rare space in many civilized societies where bellicosity is not only tolerated, it's celebrated. Brutal punishment is seen and sold stoically as the only solution for success. The football helmet is not just a form of protection, but conversely a means of dehumanization, the mask to better shield one's opponent from eliciting any girly empathy. For players themselves, there's the lurid allure of getting jacked up on the gridiron. It's intoxicating. It's a drug that gives you the most incredible feeling there is. Outside of sexual intercourse, there's probably nothing like it. Another interviewee evoked this contradiction of violence as tranquility in an even more zen-like fashion. The one thing that I miss more than anything in football is there's a very, very, very micro millisecond, I don't know if it's measurable, when you get tackled or you make a tackle, that everything goes to black. There's a peacefulness, and it's almost like you're dead. It's so fast that it doesn't really exist. The world is silent. Your brain basically shuts off for a fraction. Maybe I shouldn't worship that as much as I did when I was younger, but it was just this incredible experience. Announcers legitimize this violence with homilies of adoration for those who can suck it up and play through the pain. This is the cruel paradox of sport. Participation almost guarantees eventual injury, but our culture celebrates only those healthy competitors who survive that winnowing. And those survivors dare not call it luck, lest the meritocracy of a training regimen lose its luster. Tom Brady's ability to defy the cruel and inevitable gravity of aging gets sold literally as the TB12 method, body as temple, rather than fate as capricious. And yet, a culture of callous indifference to and misty admiration for bodily suffering as properly manly seems to be slowly evolving. CTE-inducing concussions make what once seemed manly seem more barbaric. One interviewee laments, "The collisions, the violence, every week, you hold your breath, hoping that somebody isn't paralyzed. I'm sharing the guilt of, why am I covering this, or why am I interested in a sport where this could happen?" One ESPN football analyst of two decades resigned in 2017 specifically because of his growing discomfort with brain trauma. By mid-decade, four times as many NFL players under 30 had retired compared to 5 years earlier. But none of this newfound sensitivity should suggest that American sports culture has gotten any more hospitable to women. I still get tweets to go back in the kitchen. They're worried about color of hair and how a woman looks. If I was as fat and bald as some male sportscasters, I would not have that job. These could be credible women, Emmy award-winning reporters, but you reach a certain age, and instead of saying, we need to give you a pay cut, they just let you go and go to someone cheaper. Indeed, 90% of sports page editors, 95% of sports anchors, and 99% of sports commentators are dudes. In 2017, the first female broadcaster in two decades called a March Madness game. A year later, the first ever called Monday Night Football. On Twitter, she was roundly mocked for sounding, and I quote, shrill. One of my interviewees at a major sports network anonymously confided to me that their head of on-camera talent got fired for telling women there to glam it up, wear tight clothes, show cleavage, wear high heels. Me Too is a ticking time bomb within the sports world that has not yet gone off. Moreover, these women feel a contradictory double bind, being expected to look good, but by virtue of looking good, that costing them credibility. I can make an honest mistake about a statistic, or get a player's name wrong, or mispronounce something, and the immediate reaction from a still too large segment of the public is going to be, "That's why women shouldn't talk sports," Jamel Hill told me. On the field, the gender disparity is no better. A 3-decade-long longitudinal survey of sports media finds that both ESPN and local news spend about 2-3% of their time on women's sports. It was not until the 1990s that women's sports began receiving more attention, barely, than horses and dogs. Serena Williams' selection as SI's Sports Person of the Year ignited debate as to whether American Pharoah deserved the honor, even though American Pharoah is not actually technically a sports person. D1 men's college basketball budgets tend to be 10 times larger than those of women's. World Cup prize money is $600 million for men and $15 million for women. And a circular logic bedevils women's sports coverage. Resources and hype help generate ratings, which in turn wind up justifying the use of those resources. And yet, we're also living through a moment of profound masculine insecurity, as the means of production change dramatically, both off the field and on. Sports once dramatized working-class life for a proletariat fan base. Construction, manufacturing, coal mining, a physicality of purpose was men's reason for existence. At games, when men look up from work email on smartphones, they see ancestral toil, aestheticized as competitive ballet. It's not coincidence that Atlantic writer Hannah Rosen declared prematurely the end of men during the same period when sports fandom and sports labor was changing so dramatically. Women have muscled their way into the majority of the American workforce for the first time in American history, but muscles are precisely not a prerequisite for the post-industrial economy. These are, moreover, not your grandfather's games. Sport itself seems to be undergoing a profound digital and data-driven labor disruption, just like the real world of work. Post-Moneyball, post-fantasy sports, there has never been more obsession with statistically converting the physical experience of athletic activity and venerating those who can manipulate the figures effectively. For centuries, sports heroes were avatars of brawn. Today, we find an increasing number whose domination of sport is brainy, not bodily, whether in front offices or in office pools. Theo Epstein was arguably as idolized as any player on the Cubs 2016 roster that he constructed. Massive amounts of performance data and biometrics are fed into regular regression analysis thanks to Panoptic basketball smart courts, MLB sensory compression sleeves, NFL tracking chips and shoulder pads, and the U.S. soccer team running DNA sequencing on players. The Houston Astros front office included a former NASA biomathematician. This is not exactly the dumb jock stereotype of hegemonic masculinity. There will be two kinds of coaches around the world. There are going to be coaches who believe in this kind of analytics and engage with it, and there are going to be former coaches. Their operating system, in other words, is simply out of date. Similarly out of date are the attitudes that we have about sports and politics. For decades, we've been told these shouldn't mix, or as Laura Ingraham reprimanded LeBron James, just shut up and dribble. Now, there's clearly a fan base for that censorship. A national survey I fielded of Americans found that about half thought that sports and politics should stay separate, and only 1 in 5 thought that they shouldn't. Yet it's precisely because sports are perceived and protected as separate from politics and neutral on issues of ideology that they can powerfully serve power. For the two issues that have most dominated U.S. politics in the 21st century are also deeply intertwined with sports culture. Economic inequality at home, and military intervention abroad. To understand the first, we need to examine the core creed of American sports. No other form of pop culture escapism so consistently embeds a narrative that explains achievement in terms of meritocracy. In sports, winners succeed because they work hard. Think about it. Rare is the exultant athlete hoisting the trophy at the victor's podium who references the team's free agency binge in the offseason. Rare is the sports writer who can resist the heartwarming tale of a superstar born into poverty, hustling his or her way out of the hood. Rare is the fan who doesn't swoon for the 16-seed Cinderella story, the underdog slaying Goliaths. We love this self-made hero of sports culture, who through work ethic alone attains these heights and suggests that that advancement is open to all. The locker room is the ultimate laboratory. It doesn't matter that your father went to college or your mother had a lot of money. It matters if you hit the jumper. This is how the elite in sports are rationalized. They're willing to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, every day, 350 days a year, sacrifice everything, time with family, friends, community, to be the best. This threads through the majority of inspirational quotes slapped up on locker room walls and the homilies that shoe companies churn out about willpower and discipline, qualities that are available to all of us. The sweaty means are the pleasurable ends in Under Armour's sadomasochistic moral universe. Awestruck, this ideology nudges spectators to see those who won success in society beyond sport as equally deserving by dint of effort. And the Protestant sports ethic posits that those who are condemned to losing are to blame for their chosen indolence. This teaches a lesson about the failure of laziness and the laziness of failures. That always struck me as odd. Everybody in sports work hard. I've gone to Indiana's preseason training camp for 9 straight years, and they're working just as hard as Ohio State is. They just don't have very good players. And yet, that explanatory narrative, the advantage of innate talent, is usually bypassed in favor of more meritocratic, democratic lullabies. Sports tells us that the world is a level playing field. They tell us that the source of success is not some pre-existing privilege, whether that be genetic blessings individually or Steinbrennerian spendthrift on behalf of the team, but rather the blood, sweat, and tears that anyone could have committed themselves to if they just had enough gumption. Pull yourself up by your own Air Jordans, because if you don't, you only have yourself to blame. It's hard to see how it's not a political message at a moment in American history defined by grotesque levels of financial inequality. When the top 0.1% and the bottom 90% now retain about the same share of the nation's wealth. When American CEOs reap 300 times the salary of their average employee. Sports offers a persuasive script for articulating capitalist catechism. It doesn't explain economic disparity in the sense of cause, but it does help rationalize and legitimize the gap between haves and have-nots. And public opinion reflects this. We found that sports fans are more likely than non-fans to believe that economic outcomes reflect meritocratic processes. In other words, sports fans are more likely to believe that hard work and ambition determines whether you get ahead, as opposed to growing up with wealth or better schools. The Nike bootstraps are right there for the taking. Speaking of bootstraps, if economic anxieties dominated this decade in American history, then the war on terror defined our politics before that. Sports has similarly camouflaged itself in militaristic pretense. Ike once declared, "The true mission of American sports is to prepare young people for war. Fighter jets buzz overhead at big games. Soldiers are shown watching overseas. Fox's NFL panel dons fatigues at an Afghan base." And yet, two Republican senators exposed how the Pentagon spends an upwards of $10 million for all that patriotism, enlistment inductions, surprise homecomings, thanking the troops on the Jumbotron screen. I argue that dressing up players as soldiers cheapens the commitment of the latter to mere performance and play when it's anything but. It's a sanitized way of remembering the troops so as to just as quickly forget about their sacrifice. It's unearned catharsis. To make ourselves feel good, right, we bring out the soldier who has had this miserable experience defending our freedoms that we don't know about, that we wouldn't send our kids to be part of. If we give them a standing ovation, somehow we feel like we've, not that we've washed our hands of it, but we've acknowledged it, now let's get on with the game. For sports media, it's the least we can do is often the rote cliche trotted out when narrating troop salutes, but they might as well be speaking on behalf of all of us in America. The mission drift of endless deployments over the course of 2 decades has drained military engagement from the forefront of our consciousness. In the post-draft era, it's sacrifice borne by somebody else's kids. It mirrors a foreign policy on autopilot, maintaining indefinite missions that enable us to avoid the hard questions about the wisdom and strategy of the wars that we have shipped them off to. The Pentagon, with its $600 billion annual budget, clearly needs to buy that allegiance and goodwill, and our national survey finds that it probably does. Sports fans are more likely than non-fans to support increased defense spending. Through sports, we see guerrilla marketing in a double sense. Selling us war, and selling it to us with a very subtle way of doing it. So Bob Costas told me, as I wrap up here, when people say don't talk about sports, what they're really saying is don't say anything I don't want to hear or anything I don't agree with. This is because the conservative politics that are already inside sports are invisible and permissible, while those that are out of bounds are obtrusive, illegitimate, and left-leaning. Just ask Kaepernick. Now, to be fair, sports do offer us something sacred, shared, and synchronizing. For people who have at least some space where they feel a sense of camaraderie, a sense of connection, that to me is understandable in the way in which needing water or food is utterly understandable. Increasingly, however, those benefits come at a price. For who really owns our identity as fans? even if we delude ourselves into conflating that community with some kind of possessiveness over the totem we adore, you can't pass down something that ultimately isn't yours to give. Just ask any of my fellow San Diegans whose hearts were broken when there was more brand equity to be looted up Interstate 5. Sports loyalty only runs one way. The power of sports in final judgment is definitional. It tells us who we are at the individual, local, and national level, furnishing the character we crave and the status we fetishize. It defines what time it is across the arc of seasons-long history as tradition accumulates, and in the immediate, ephemeral, immersive nature of a single game being played, a single moment that you can't look away from. It defines who matters in terms of masculine bias, and what's right in life and in America in terms of meritocratic and militaristic myths. Sports are our most powerful cultural mirror. They're not an escape from external realities. They're a reflection of them. The games seem like they should be meaningless, but instead they can be the most solid thing that we know. They can make us feel as alive as we feel. I share his faith in this. I believe that it is that animating power that brings to life not just individual experience, but, far more importantly, some kind of collective consciousness. I appreciate that solidity that he describes and the subsequent solidarity derived from it when social experience seems to fray and fragment. And I'm humbled by the way that sports can fill a contemporary spiritual vacuum, how it can make us feel good about ourselves and the world. The power of sports is, in the end, what happens out of bounds. Thanks very much for listening today.
Mike, when Gordon Dee left being president of Ohio State, he was asked what made him a successful president. And Gordon Dee said, well, if a president gives parking to the faculty, sex to the undergraduates, and football to the alumni, he will be a very successful president. Now, here at BC, I can't comment on the first one. But I will say that, as you well know, as a faculty member, one of the three things that faculty talk about is the amount of money Boston College spends on sports. And when I was a dean, I always asked for a breakdown of that, a disaggregation of the actual money. And I was told by the provost, you can't do that. And I said, well, if we can send somebody to the moon, we can disaggregate how much program costs. What you BC is ostensibly a Jesuit and Catholic school. How do you think BC uses football?
Oh, gosh. Am I on record here still?
Turn off the mic.
Yeah. No, I will say this. So a couple of things. So your point about disaggregating is really interesting because of the research that I've seen over the years, I think it's somewhere in the range of 20 to 30 universities actually earn a profit in some way off of sports.
And BC's not one of them.
No, you're talking about the Notre Dames, the Texases, the Michigans, the North Carolinas, and so on. I think that clearly I have tremendous ambivalence about sports, right? I'm a fan. I love them. I believe that they do serve some deep spiritual purpose for us. But I think also, hopefully, what comes through is my anxiety about how much money we do allocate to them. I think without dodging the question too much, I would say that sports can and do serve a purpose of unifying student body, unifying the alums. It does serve a deep and meaningful and valuable social purpose. But there are also other priorities that equally serve that purpose. And unfortunately, I think a lot of those other priorities don't have the luster, the attention that sports gets, right? So sports, if you look at different competing priorities at university, sports has home field advantage in a metaphorical sense, right? Because other things that a university does, other activities, don't fill a stadium like we have down there. And also, let's be clear, when we're talking about, it's easy to confuse and talk about sports in general at a university when you're actually just talking about football and men's basketball. And there's a way in which I think, you can easily assume that all sports are on that same stage in terms of resources and on that same stage in terms of attentiveness, but really you're talking about two sports that tend to dominate the landscape in very particular gendered ways, I think, that I've tried to point out here. So, yeah, that was my dodge. other thoughts, other takes on this. Yeah.
What do you think about the fact that sports, to go to an event, to a football game, has become so economically unattainable?
Oh.
And how that affects you know, my husband and I want to bring my daughter to a Patriots game, and we have these huge discussions, like, is it worth $400 to go to one game? So what is your thoughts on just the socialization and how expensive sports are?
Yeah, it's a product of sports, particularly the sort of big four sports, chasing a more lucrative consumer, right? Routinely when a team comes to a city and says they need a new stadium, what they mean is we need more luxury boxes for corporate benefactors and things like that. The stadium's still fine. I mean, even like I'm from San Diego and our stadium's junk and it's falling apart, but it's still fine, right? But it could not accommodate the more elite patrons. So I think what you see there, what you describe, and what saddens me as well, because I would argue, aside from baseball, just because of the sheer number of games that get played, the other three sports are more or less economically completely unfeasible for most, middle class or much less working class folks. I think that that's because sports is chased after this extremely lucrative, valuable demographic that they can charge a lot more for, right? I mean, it's the same event that you're watching, but the cheap seats are paying one price, right? Whereas you can charge, a luxury box person, an order of magnitude much more for that price. So I think it's catering to, in some of the same ways, the economic trends that we've seen in terms of the super elite and the super wealthy in America taking a greater share of sort of national wealth. But, yeah, Kristen.
Mike, what are your thoughts on sort of what's happening now with the conversation around allowing student athletes to profit during their time in university, be it endorsements, signatures, things along those lines? And personally, what do you think? And then where do you see this kind of heading?
Gosh, the second question I'll totally dodge because I could not speak to whether or not this will be the profound shift that some think that it might be, right? It could definitely reshape things massively. Now, what's my own personal take on it? So I haven't read in detail about the legislation that they've got out in California, but at the top level, from what I've seen, I think it's positive. I think that I've never had a good explanation given to me to how you would have a university pay athletes that would not be in violation of Title IX in some way. In other words, the big programs at any university, BC, etc., that bring in a lot of the money tend to be men's basketball and college football, right? And so if you were to say, well, we need to pay athletes, so we're going to pay athletes everybody the same, right? Because you have to do so because of Title IX legislation. The legislation in California, it strikes me as a way of allowing somebody else to sort of intervene in that financial transaction that would not keep the university in a discriminatory sort of footing. And I think it's completely fine. Like, it does not make any sense to me that that college athletes should not be able to profit from their likeness in some way or profit when the university is doing so and when everybody else is. I don't think the university should pay them, but I think they should be allowed to get paid. And the notion that this will somehow corrupt the integrity or start having games being thrown, I think is infantilizes athletes in a way that if a year later when they go pro, they're able to take those same things without throwing games or corrupting the games that they play at the professional level, why can't they do so in the college level? So that's sort of, my slightly unformed take on that, but I'm super fascinated to see how that plays out because I think it will reshape things. And there is the one counter-argument that I have read is that this could cost the university money because now if all of a sudden Under Armour can just sponsor single athletes, they'll no longer want to sponsor like BC as a whole, right? There's that possible consequence. That's something to consider. It's not an easy issue. I'd be curious whether or not that's hype or whether that plays out. So,
what do you see as the path forward for the rehabilitation of sports? I mean, given that it's mirroring culture, does it require some sort of social revolution? Or given that it sort of forms the way we think, can sports be reformed in a way that it becomes normative in social transformation in a different way?
Yeah, that's a big question. Can the problems of sports be fixed? Yes, I do think. And let me take a couple of those problems individually. So I have all the hope in the world that my six-year-old daughter will come of age in a very different landscape in terms of gender and sports than we have right now. I think that I think that soccer is going to be the thing that could potentially lead us toward more of an equitable landscape in terms of sexism and gender. I think that the tremendous outpouring of support and ratings and popularity of the U.S. Women's National Team is indicative of that. I think that there's the potential. I think broadly, you know, soccer in general is a sport. If sports were stocks, soccer would be a stock that I would buy in the U.S. I'd sell baseball. I'd buy basketball and I'd hold football. This is like a Moody's rating agency or whatever. I think that there is potential. I think that we will see young fans, many I think gathered in the room today, a lot of my students. Thank you so much for coming, by the way. I think that we will see young fans demanding and desiring and rewarding a more equitable gender landscape for sports. That's my hope. With regard to some of the other problems, I don't think that sports will change its narrative around justifying economic inequality in any way. I think that's baked so deeply into the logic of sports culture that if America is going to do something about economic inequality, it will not come from sports as a contributor to trying to address those problems. I just think it's baked really deeply into sports culture in a way that I couldn't even conceptualize how you would extract it from that. And then, you know, in terms of the other sort of problem of sports being intertwined with an unthinking militarism, I think that will also persist. Throughout world history, sports and militarism has been intertwined. The ancient, you know, Romans thought that it was rehearsal for war. During the British colonial empire, they loved to train young men on the fields of Eton, I think it is, playing soccer because they thought that this would help the colonial wars around the globe. 100 years ago, Pierre de Coubertin, who founded the modern Olympics, more or less did so because he wanted to whip the youth of France in shape for the next war that would come. So sports and militarism, I think, has a long history that I don't think will ever be disentangled. But I do have more hope on the possibility of some progress or improvement as it pertains to gender and sexism in sports. Yeah.